Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 2018 has been a major year for food, and do I love food. There have been all kinds of exciting trends when it comes to what's on the plate, but there's also been some really deep cultural changes and losses to restaurants and to kitchens around the country. Joining me now to talk about some of the year's highest highs and lowest lows in food is Amy Traverso, senior food editor for Yankee Magazine. Amy, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be back.
I'm glad. Hey, it's been a big year for me, too, and time's up in restaurants. Listeners, have you worked in a restaurant? How has the culture changed or not changed in the kitchen? Or are you thinking about food? How have you changed the way you eat this year? What new recipes are you following? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Amy, I want to talk about the food, but first I want to talk about the culture around it. Let's start there because it's been a big year. Mm-hmm. Just yesterday, L'Espalier, the modern French restaurant in the Back Bay, announced its closing without fanfare after 40 years. They'll close on December 31st. What does the city lose with the closing of this restaurant, and what, whether it's a restaurant or a cuisine, do you think is going to fill that void?
Well, I think, you know, Frank McClellan, the owner and chef at L'Espalier, has been such a bar setter for quality in Boston. And, you know, he was really instrumental in bringing the kind of farm-to-table aesthetic to truly fine dining, mm-hmm. to a place where it's silver and white tablecloths and there's somebody coming out with a cheese cart and it's fancy, fancy. You know, he said his lease is up and he just wasn't interested in renewing it. He has a farm up in Essex, Massachusetts that he's running. He says he has an unnamed project in the works. I think really what it means is, you know, the way people want to eat now is so different. We want shared plates. We want to be more casual. Dining out doesn't have to, fine dining doesn't have to be fancy. Mm-hmm. And I think for him to pivot, to roll with that change with a restaurant like L'Espalier, it would have been like turning around a luxury yacht in a very tight space. Like, I'm not sure L'Espalier could have been reimagined to cater to that contemporary way of dining. So I guess what we lose is a little bit of that elevated elegance. You know, Lockober's gone and it's been replaced with Yvonne's, which is really cool and sexy and elegant, but more casual than Lockober was. And I think L'Espalier was kind of one of the last of its kinds. I think we're going to be left with a lot of steakhouses when you want to get to that really expensive, fancy, formal service kind of restaurant.
So we're keeping the good food, but we're losing some of the fancy.
Yeah. And a little bit of the sitting for 4 hours for dinner. That's not all that L'Espalier did. But I mean that people are a little less patient with those kind of multi-course dinners.
All right. Now, it was a year of loss in some other areas, too. We lost a number of really influential chefs and food writers. Most notably, of course, is Anthony Bourdain, the writer, the travel documentarian, and celebrity chef. He committed suicide tragically, which really reverberated not just, you know, in these intense foodie circles, but for so many people around the world. We lost some other big figures this year, too. Joël Robuchon, who was a French celebrity chef, he died at age 73. Paul Bocuse, also a French chef, died at 91. And the LA Times and Pulitzer Prize-winning restaurant critic Jonathan Gold died young. Yeah. At 57. What kind of effect do those losses have on the food and restaurant community?
Well, I think, certainly the reverberations with Anthony Bourdain's death, I think, continue. I think people just felt so personally connected to him. He was also famously just a very generous person with his time, his encouragement. So there are a lot of people who felt that he'd not just touched their lives through his writing, but it actually, you know, helped make an introduction or just encourage them in their work in the food world. So I think people really feel his loss. And of course, it was so shocking. Jonathan Gold, I mean, what a singular voice. I actually was rereading some of his work, and it brought tears to my eyes how beautifully he wrote about everything from, you know, fine dining in L.A. to taco trucks and why it's so the joy of eating at a taco truck at, you know, 11 o'clock at night in the winter in L.A. So those are just voices that are irreplaceable. Other voices will come, obviously, along. But, you know, Jonathan Gold, he was the first food writer to win a Pulitzer Prize for criticism. That was a huge benchmark. And I think it set a bar for the rest of us. And, you know, as far as great chefs, they changed cuisine as we knew it. know it. They brought a modern spirit to French cooking, and you know, their influence, their dishes, in particular, Joël Robuchon. He did a dish with a version of potatoes, pommes souffle. Potatoes that were cooked equal part. It was basically equal parts butter and potato. That dish, I see it in other restaurants as a tribute to him. So I think his dishes will live on for sure.
I actually really like the juxtaposition of the 4-hour meal with the 11 p.m. taco truck in New York.
Yes.
It just sort of gives us the full expanse of food and how we love to engage with it and consume it.
Yeah.
You know, I have really felt like 2018 was another really important year for women, strong mm-hmm. women, vocal women. You know, hashtag Me Too and Time's Up both really took hold in the restaurant world this year. Among many incidents in September, the Times-Picayune reported that 25 women, 25, were sexually harassed while working for the Besh Restaurant Group down in New Orleans, owned by, co-owned by celebrity chef John Besh. Are we seeing those kinds of claims and that culture play out in the greater Boston restaurant scene as well?
Not nearly as much, which is not to say that those things haven't happened in Boston. But I really think this is a moment when we can give our city some credit, because in a way that no other city has managed to replicate, Boston has long been led by women chefs, and women chefs who own multiple restaurants. Think of Barbara Lynch and Jody Adams, Lydia Shire and Anna Sorton, Joanne Chang. Having these women in such senior roles has, I think, changed the entire culture of Boston, food culture and the restaurant culture, because their protégés have gone on to open their own restaurants. And so they're cross-pollinating the city and making Boston a place where many women run kitchens. And that completely, I mean, if you want to change the kitchen culture, if you want to change that macho frat guy culture that ran kitchens for decades, that's a really good way to do it, is to put a woman in charge. So I really give... I think a lot of it was maybe Julia Child setting a certain expectation that women could be leaders in food. And the women who came up after her have changed the culture. And that's maybe one reason why we haven't seen as many explosive revelations out of Boston. I'd also say, you know, I used to work at Boston Magazine. I was food editor there. And there was a time where there were these kind of packs of chef dudes roaming the city, and their antics were kind of legendary. Now I'd say that culture seems to have really gone away. That is not something that anybody's bragging about anymore. It's just not as big a leader in the restaurant culture.
Okay. So it's encouraging to hear about these strong women leaders. It's encouraging to hear that maybe we're ahead of the curve. We're still not immune to the cultural problems. Earlier this year, Tiffany Faison, who is a co-owner of Sweet Cheeks Q and Tiger Mama, she told Meghna Chakrabarty that it was what it was like coming up as a female chef in the Boston food scene. Let's listen to that.
You know, I remember when I first started working at Daniel Ballou's restaurant in the Wynn, and I was at that point, I was the chef de partie on fish, which is a difficult station. You lead the fish station. And I had some kid come over from Garmager, and he was like, hey, you want to trade? And I thought, like, he was a line cook, and I was already, like, two positions above him. And just that, like, blind ignorance of, like, hey, you want to trade? Like, no, I've worked my butt off for this.
Now, despite those challenges coming up in the Boston food world, she was a finalist for the 2018 James Beard Award for Best Chef of the Northeast. And speaking of culture change, interestingly, earlier this year, the James Beard Award Foundation, which awards that prize, announced that in the wake of the Time's Up movement, the committee is going to consider restaurant culture and leadership values when making their determinations for Best Chef. Do you see this awareness and these kinds of changes improving kitchen culture? Are you optimistic?
I'm optimistic. I think, you know, a lot of traditional kitchens were based on the French model, which was incredibly militaristic and strictly hierarchical. It was very hard for women to find, as Tiffany said, and she's another example of a woman who's with multiple restaurants who's changed the culture. It was very hard for women to enter that culture. As that becomes dismantled, you're now, you know, the classic image of the macho chef throwing pans at the underlings, swearing, carrying on, being ridiculous, unprofessional, that just doesn't fly anymore. You know, restaurants used to be a place where people who maybe couldn't fit into corporate America could find a place to be themselves and be creative. But what went along with that was a lot of bad behavior. I think what we're figuring out now is you don't have to act like a jerk to be creative and still be a little bit outside the cookie cutter, you know, corporate culture.
I hope that we're learning in lots of places that you don't have to act like a jerk to be creative. All right, I want to shift gears just a little bit from food culture to food policy, and I want to talk about SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's the U.S. Food Assistance Program, and it's kind of a perennial lightning rod in the wars about welfare and welfare benefits. Earlier this month, President Trump announced that his administration was going to try to tighten work requirements for adults who rely on SNAP, which is also food stamps. And that's probably going to mean that more people are going to lose their benefits. Last week, the president explained the decision at a press conference. Let's listen to that for a sec.
Millions of able-bodied working-age adults continue to collect food stamps without working or even looking for work. Our goal is to move these Americans from dependence to independence and into a good-paying job and rewarding career.
Okay, so now we've got food at the center of this battle about the role of government and of welfare. And I think it's especially poignant because the Obama administration put such an emphasis on food, nutrition, and healthful choices with things like the First Lady's Let's Move campaign and her push for Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. The Trump administration has been criticized for trying to water down some of these policies. And I wonder, what do you make of food finding itself at the heart of these particular political and culture wars?
Well, it's interesting. I still find it interesting when I'm talking to people about food, and they'll kind of ask me, well, why is food writing interesting or why is food writing important? And I say, well, what was the first thing you did this morning? Chances are you ate food. And there are a lot of things that go into the eggs that ended up in your frying pan or the coffee that was in your mug. There's policy, there's culture. I mean, that's why I love writing and thinking about food, because for me, it's sort of a liberal arts education that never ends. You know, the Farm Bill is a massive undertaking. It comes up every 5 years. It's a package that regulates, you know, $867 billion of spending. And a lot of what happens in the hashing out of the Farm Bill is a battle between representatives from rural areas and representatives from urban areas. The rural areas want a lot of aid for farmers who are being affected by the trade war, by climate change, by a lot of other things, by, you know, instability in the commodities market. Urban senators and congresspeople want funding for things like SNAP and farmers markets, and they're duking it out in there. Fortunately, you know, the compromise bill that did pass did not include the restrictions that the House wanted to pass on SNAP and food aid. Mm-hmm. However, I know the Trump administration wants to work around it and try to sort of backdoor that the cutbacks on those programs. So we'll see what happens. You know, fingers crossed. There are some good news, though. I mean, there's quadrupling in funding on organic research on organic farming. It'll be very interesting to see what happens as hemp has become legalized on an industrial scale. Mm-hmm. We're looking at a $20 billion hemp industry coming down the pike and a lot of CBD oil coming out of that. So
all right.
That'll be interesting.
So, Amy, we've got just a little bit of time left, and I feel like we should actually talk about food, too. So tell us what kind of food trends you saw this past year, particularly here in the New England region.
So there's been a lot, and it's been fun to watch. One thing I'm seeing is this kind of next level idea of health food. I mean, I remember in the 80s, everybody was eating oat bran to bring down their cholesterol. So health food is nothing new, clearly. But there's a different tone to it. I was trying to put my finger. Why is it different? I was seeing a lot of emphasis on nutraceuticals and ingredients that were anti-inflammatory. And inflammation is like the bugaboo, right? Matcha, cacao, turmeric. And I realize that I think what's happening here, why we've become so fixated on adding these nutraceuticals to our food, is because I think there's a sense of chaos in our external environment, climate change. There's a lot of anxiety about our health and our future. And these foods represent a way for us to take control of our internal environment. That's one area where we have control. Mm-hmm. I think that might be behind this because there's a heating up of that bet. But let's talk about fun stuff. Tahini is like been in everywhere. Everybody's putting tahini in their brownies, in their donuts, in savory sauces.
And what is in tahini?
Tahini's basically, it's like peanut butter but made with sesame seeds. And so you see it traditionally in a lot of Middle Eastern cuisines, in halva, which is like candied. It's almost like a fudge made with tahini. You'll see it everywhere. Look for that. Look for Portuguese food to be kind of a hot cuisine in the next year. Boston and Massachusetts have a large Portuguese population. In Providence, Rhode Island, there's a new Portugale market that is sort of like a small version of Italy for Portuguese food.
Yeah.
There's also been a lot of interest in travel to Portugal. It's relatively affordable. I'm seeing a lot of Instagram trips to Portland. So when you see that kind of tourism interest, chances are people are going to come back and they're going to be wanting to eat that food.
Do you have a favorite Portuguese dish?
That's such a good question. I mean, Portuguese food is so great when it comes to sort of beautiful wood-grilled fish with great olive oil. I love that. Love dried salt cod and all the different yummy things you can make with that. Love the uses of sort of those warm, smoky spices. So love Portuguese wine, too. So there's a lot there to explore. Sprinkles. Everybody's obsessed with sweet and savory sprinkles right now.
Sprinkles
sprinkles are, and I think that's driven a lot by Instagram, but also savory ones. Middle Eastern spice blends like Duca and za'atar and everything bagel sprinkles on everything. Yeah. So that's one of the lighter trends that's sort of fun to watch.
Excellent. Yeah. All right. And on that note, one last trend that you expect in 2019 that we should be looking for.
Alternative flours, not just for people with gluten sensitivities. Rye flour, buckwheat flour, they are delicious and so much more interesting than white flour. So look for them in baked goods, in breads, even in pasta.
Wow. Okay, alternative flours. That's Amy Traverso, senior food editor at Yankee Magazine. Amy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston.